Founding support for State of Wonder is provided by the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation. Additional funding by the U.S. Bank Foundation and Chuck and Nancy Tommen. Also, funding for arts and culture programming on OPB is provided by the Robert D. and Marcia H. Randall Charitable Trust and the Oregon Arts Commission.
This is State of Wonder for Saturday, the 7th of March, 2015. Good afternoon. I'm April Baer. Today, some new visual art that tries to address urban decay without treating it like a sideshow.
I didn't want to go and document ruins in Detroit, for example, because I don't think it's fair for people that live in Detroit having this guy out of town overestheticizing their pain.
Also, writer Geronimo Johnson talks about his dizzying new satirical novel. It's about what happens when performance art goes horribly wrong. My friend, we've seen that happen once or twice, haven't we? But first, we're going to kick things off today with a couple of stone-cold women, amazing creators working in completely different fields. First up, Kim Gordon. Her autobiography, Girl in a Band, is making waves this week. Gordon is the co-founder of the massively influential indie rock band Sonic Youth. She's in a weird place right now. The band went nuclear in 2011 when Gordon's longtime husband and bandmate, Thurston Moore, had an affair, and they broke up. Gordon came to Powell's in Beaverton this week to talk about her new book. We wanted to get a sense of why Gordon is so beloved by the fans. OPB producer John Sepulveda chased down a few of the faithful. We'll hear in Gordon from a minute, but first let's listen to what John sent us.
My name is Sean Swaggerty.
My name is Claudia Meza.
People call me Swag.
My name is James Deneen. I live in Portland, Oregon.
I live in North Portland.
I'm a grown adult, and I know how to cook fairly well.
The first I heard of Kim Gordon, I was a freshman at Emerson College in Boston.
I was a student at University of Montana.
I first became aware of Kim Gordon through a magazine article about Sonic Youth.
In Art Forum magazine.
Yeah, I believe it was like Spin.
I had a very fragile mind at that point, so I was very malleable to musical influence. And some kid down the hallway was playing Daydream Nation.
When I first heard her voice, I thought, this is unexpected.
I actually thought she sounds like she's from L.A.
Very first thing that came to my mind was, I gotta see what this woman looks like.
It was just kind of soft and calm, but still very spooky and kind of scary.
And when I saw her, the archetypal notion of the rock chick was completely shattered.
And I'm like, I know this person. I know who she is. I hang out with her. She has a very distinct Southern California accent, and I loved hearing it. I remember the first time I saw Sonic Youth.
And it was in Central Park in New York City. It was an outdoor show.
In 1987.
1990.
Bikini Kill was opening up.
The sound was terrible.
I missed Bikini Kill. I was really bummed about that.
And it was the noisiest thing that I had ever encountered to that point.
The best show I ever saw her play was, it was called, I think, The Big Outing or Big Day Out, and it was in L.A. They had all of their instruments stolen from them that day, and it was this really cathartic performance. She came out in this, wearing high heels and a designer dress, and at that point, I was already, like, rolling my eyes about Kim Gordon's outfit and who she, I was like, she doesn't even play bass anymore. But then they played Death Valley 69. All the guitars they were playing, I had just seen previous like bands play because they were just borrowing them. And the only tunings they remembered were their first tunings, and they were all E. So it was, they basically just played the first 5 years of Sonic Youth. And she was so mad that she fell and her heel broke. And then she grabbed that heel and threw it and just started throwing her shoes on her bass, just going crazy. And, like, every, like, judgmental thing I had about, you know, posh Kim Gordon just went out. And I was like, she is a mother badass.
I think Kim Gordon is very important as an artist,
she's an inspiring and courageous figure.
She has changed a lot of the way that I view women in music.
She showed one can bridge all of these worlds, no wave, the art world, the pop world, the fashion world.
I was reading an interview with Kim Gordon, and she stated that she realized that a lot of her confidence and self-validation came from, like, finishing a project. And she stated, like, hey, that's not right. That's messed up. And it made me realize that that's what I was doing. It was something very odd where I was like, oh, it is messed up. You shouldn't put your entire identity, you know, on a band or on a creative project, or because those could go away. It's ephemeral, and then you're just left empty and crushed. And that was happening to me over and over again. And just reading those words that someone I respected said, you know, I just felt like she basically blew my mind. It was like this, oh, I need to go to therapy. Like, I read that paragraph and I was like, oh, I'm not right.
Voices of Sean Swaggerty, Claudia Meza, and James Dineen, all huge fans of Sonic Youth. Kim Gordon talked about her own sense of being under the thrall of Sonic Youth's music this week on OPB's Fresh Air. She made no bones about the fact that gender and music were all wrapped up for her, too.
There's a certain, actually, thrill of electricity itself, and plugging a guitar into an amp and playing electric guitar is a very visceral, physical thing. Like, your movements can affect the sound of the guitar, and I related to that in a way that, because I always like to do dance, I kind of related to that on a certain level that I hadn't expected. There were times, yeah, when it felt really great to be just surrounded by the sound and music, not knowing what was going to happen.
You can hear all of Terry Gross's interview with Kim Gordon if you're into it. Find the link on our page this week. It's opb.org/stateofwonder. For their 30th anniversary, Literary Arts has been partnering with OPB to bring the Archive Project to air. It's a series of talks and lectures from renowned authors and poets. Today we're dipping in to listen to Portland's own Ursula K. Le Guin. She drew some fire this week. Did you read her critique of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, The Buried Giant? Ishiguro has worried about alienating readers with a foray into fantasy, but Le Guin is a longtime champion of this genre, and she said people who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons from within. In this lecture from the year 2000, Le Guin spoke to another question. Where do ideas come from?
Where do writers get their ideas from?
That is the question which people in my line of work, fiction writers, get asked probably the most often. And we never know how to answer it. And so in self-defense, most of us develop a soundbite. And I like Harlan Ellison's. He says he gets his ideas from a mail order house in Schenectady. Now, when people ask, where do you get your ideas from? What some of them really want to know is the address of that mail order company. That is, they want to write, or more likely what they want is to be a writer, because they know writers are rich and famous. And they know that there are secrets that writers know, like that address in Schenectady. And they know if they can just learn those secrets, those mystical P.O. box numbers, they will be Stephen King. But alas, writers really don't have secrets, except maybe the well-kept secret that about 99% of us are neither rich nor famous. Writers talk. Writers blab. Writers are wordy people. They talk and they whine. They whine all the time to each other about what they're writing and how it isn't going well. And they teach writing workshops, and they write writing books, and they yadder, yadder, yadder on talk shows. Writers tell all. If they could tell beginning writers where to get ideas from, they would. So, why did I want to answer this foolish question, where do you get your ideas from? Because as soon as you get beneath the foolish aspect of it, the question becomes very complicated and ultimately unanswerable, and unanswerable questions are just what fiction writers love. It is a big question. Where do writers get their ideas? Where do artists get their visions? Where do musicians get their music? One of my favorite answers is this. Somebody asked Willie Nelson how he thought of his tunes. And Willie said, well, the air is full of tunes. I just reach up and pick one. Now, that is not a secret, but it is a sweet mystery. First, you have to be able to wait. I think that's what Willie didn't talk about. You wait in silence and you listen. You listen for the tune or the vision or the story. You're not grabbing, you're not pushing, you're just waiting and listening and being ready for it when it comes. This is an act of trust. To know how to make something out of the vision, that's what practice is for. The gift of practice to the artist is mastery, or the word I prefer, craft. Well, with those tools, then you do your best to let the idea, the tune, the vision, the story, to let it come through clear, undistorted by convention or fashion or, most insidious of all, opinion.
That was Ursula K. Le Guin talking about where her ideas come from. She delivered that talk for Portland Arts and Lectures back in 2000. In just a minute, two guitarists from opposite sides of the Pacific with very little in common make a record together. Is this starting to sound like a buddy movie? Yeah, we thought so too. Hang on to hear more. You're with State of Wonder on OPB. You're with State of Wonder on OPB. I'm April Baer. All right, we're going to play two artists for you real quick. This is Japanese heavy metal guitarist Takashi Ohashi. It's a track from his 80s band, Cats in Boots. Shotgun Sonny's gonna shoot him up in my town. SOS, she's making my life a mess. And this is Portland folk punk rocker Casey Neal and the Norway Rats.
Steel bridge at sundown, walking along over the poison water.
What can these two possibly have in common? A new album, as it turns out. It's called Big Bridges. We sat down this week with Ohashi and Neil to ask how their unlikely collaboration came about. Here's Takashi.
Originally, we have a mutual friend and called Joe Trump. And
he's a drummer, right?
Yeah, he's drummer and percussion as well on the album. And I asked him to see if he knows any good collaborator, good singer-songwriter to work with. That was the year 2011.
Casey, were you aware of the extent of Takashi's career when you met him?
Joe had told me about Takashi's career and the music he had done. And, you know, I watched some stuff on YouTube. Cats in Boots and Sekima 2, and I loved it, even though it was not the kind of music we were going to be working on together. I really loved it.
Now, just a word of explanation about Sekima 2. Takashi, can you shed some light for American listeners about what this band means in Japan. Is it more like Kiss or Guar or?
It's a face painted band for sure, and very theatrical and a conceptual band. The frontman is also very clever about saying jokes and talking about social things, and so it's a rock band, but also like a kind of opinion, became an opinion leader to the young generation.
So how did you first become interested in what was going on in the American acoustic scene and an alternative scene?
I grew up with American music, and I don't listen to most of Japanese music at all. When I grew up, I listened to American rock, and especially big influences like Aerosmith in the 70s, and I researching lots of roots music.
I mean, a lot of the 70s hard rock bands were very influenced by blues and roots forms.
Yeah.
How would you describe the overall sound of the finished mastered session?
It's rock music, but not only rock music.
There are elements of things that I've worked with for years, stuff that's more on the punk side of things, stuff that's more on the folk side of things. There's some real dreamy songs. The last song, Endless Blue, I Disappear, is just a really kind of open-sounding, dreamy, beautiful song.
Tell me a little bit about the process of how you wrote these songs together.
Well, Takashi had songs that were finished in their chord structure and melody. And so I put lyrics to them to sing them, which is, I've done some co-writing over the years, but one of the tricks after you've been doing writing music for a while, I think, is to break your patterns. I tend to write lyrics first, and so the music is always
the second thing.
It's the second thing. It's not secondary, but I've tried to have melodies that are hookier and not just focused on the storytelling. But these were, I could tell that they were melodies written by a musician.
Telescopes won't see far enough to detect. Launches can't get near enough.
This may sound like a ridiculous question. You've been playing for so many years. You've played in front of thousands of people. But was there anything a little frightening about working in a small group like that?
Yes, because all notes are naked. No rhythm section and not loud. But it was a very interesting challenge because the focusing only on the core, chords, pitch, lyrics, all those very basic elements we really concentrate on. So it was difficult to develop, but once we develop, and it's so powerful.
Casey Neal and Takashi Ohashi, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can catch Takashi and Casey's collaborative project, Big Bridges, this Tuesday at Secret Society.
So my name is Motoya Nakamura, and originally I wanted to be a writer, but I happen to be a photographer now. I moved from Japan in 1989. So when I came here, as I got introduced to photography, and then I got obsessed.
Motoya Nakamura worked for years as a photojournalist at the Oregonian newspaper. He'd be driving to work, and on spring days, he said, he'd see the lane of cherry trees along the Willamette River waterfront in downtown Portland. The Japanese word for them is sakura. Nakamura got curious, and he started doing some research. He learned that these cherry trees were a gift from Japan to Portland, in memory of all the Japanese Americans ordered out of their homes and detained for years during World War II.
I got more ambivalent about my own identity. Who am I? You know, when I go home and I'm like a stranger to even to my own family in Japan. And then when I come back to U.S. and then I'm still a foreigner. And also like I kind of got reflected on, you know, what it was like to first generation of Japanese American people who moved to this country during the turn of century. And then experienced World War II. that kind of prompted me to photograph Sakura there.
Some of the photos show all the springtime explosions of gorgeousness you'd expect from cherry blossom photos, but Nakamura says they're not all like that.
Some of the photographs, I went there like almost 3 a.m. in the morning, like in the middle of the night, I went back. And sometimes I just went there right before the sun rises, because that's a really tranquil moment that I can really hear them.
That's Motoyo Nakamura. His photography exhibition, Sakura Sakura, goes on view at the Nikkei Legacy Center this weekend. Special thanks to Kayo Lackey from OPB's Arts and Life Unit for bringing us that story. You'll be able to see pictures and Kayo's complete story about Motoyo Nakamura soon. Watch for it at opb.org/artsandlife. It's time now to check in with State of Wonder's cellist in residence, Nancy Ives. She's principal cello for the Oregon Symphony, but has wide and voracious musical taste, so we find her playing with a number of interesting ensembles around the region. This month, Nancy has been working on some unusual pieces for a March 13th concert with the progressive chamber group Fear No Music. It's a retrospective of the works of Louis Andriessen. Here's a little bit of his composition, Workers' Union, as played in a 2003 recording by Bang on a Can. Nancy Ives, welcome back to State of Wonder.
Hi, April. It's great to be here.
That piece, Workers' Union, was written, and I'm quoting here, for any loud-sounding group of instruments. It's been performed by many different kinds of ensembles using just about any instrumentation you can think of. That's not something you see on the score every day.
Definitely not. Just having the instrumentation unspecified is not exactly the most common thing in the world. I have to think that all those loud instrument people are happy to have their loudness welcomed instead of shushed.
Somewhere a trombonist is just going,
yes!
Yes!
Well, and I love something Andriessen said about this piece. He says, it's difficult to play in an ensemble and to remain in step, sort of like organizing and carrying on political action.
I've been looking into this guy. Louis Andriessen is a Dutch composer, and he worked in jazz and avant-garde forms before moving into symphonic and chamber works. Loves to cross genres, loves to throw in sounds that we do not typically hear in classical music. And his rhythmic style has given rise to this nickname, Mr. Unka, which, as one critic put it, his pulverizing rhythmic style, just really taking advantage of every single opportunity to pound you with what he's trying to do. Had you heard many of his works before you started practicing these?
I'm embarrassed to say he was completely off my radar screen, and I'm really excited to get to know his music through this concert. This is just, it's a great opportunity. He's so influential. He's really considered the central figure of Dutch music, and the Dutch are very artistically progressive and influential, so it's a big deal.
Well, that's the point of Fear No Music, is to get us up close and personal with works we haven't heard before. Let's talk about how you're working on these. Can the Andriessen compositions be practiced in a traditional sense?
Yes and no. For instance, one thing about Workers' Union, which I don't play, cello is not generally considered a loud instrument, is that the rhythm is notated, but the pitch is not.
What does that sound like?
The first indication on the score is inaudible.
Wow.
It gives notes. They're actual precise notes. Now, the notes are these. It comes from the poetry. It's really quite entrancing. It starts inaudible, it says. And when you begin speaking the poetry, it says almost inaudible. Eventually, sound does emerge, but this idea is derived from the poetry. It's a really beautiful poem by Cesare Pavese. Each day the silence of the lonely room closes on the rustle of movement like hair. Every day the small window opens motionless to silent air.
That's beautiful.
And you see why he starts with silence.
Yeah.
So the poetry is playing with between the border of what is audible, what's inaudible, what is still, what's moving. It's very relaxed music until there's these noises that are a little bit shocking in context. It's so quiet. You're going along with drones on the cello and sometimes singing with it, like at one point. My goal there is for my voice to blend with the sound of the cello. playing around with that sense of, is it silent or is it audible? The poem goes on to talk about the hoarse, sweet voice does not come back in the cool silence. It opens like the breath of one who speaks to the still air and is silent.
The idea of both saying something and not saying something at the same time.
Yeah.
Huh. That's fascinating. Well, Nancy Ives, always great to talk to you. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Nancy Ives, she's on stage with Fear No Music at the Alberta Rose Theater on Friday, March 13th, for the program Mr. Unka at 75. It's a retrospective of the work of Louis Andreasen. In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to Geronimo Johnson about his new novel, and we'll hear the enchanting voice of Edna Vasquez. It's State of Wonder on OPB. It's State of Wonder on OPB. I'm April Baer. This weekend, the magazine She Shreds is shining the spotlight on some fantastic women in music. The magazine is about women guitarists and bassists, and their seventh issue release party promises to be very happening. On the bill, one Edna Vasquez. She's been playing around Portland for quite a while now, but she's moving in some different musical directions. State of Wonder producer Aaron Scott has more.
This week, our friends at OPB Music premiered a new stage pass video for the band No Passengers. It's a four-piece fronted by the singer and guitarist Edna Vasquez that gleefully jumps genres, melding jazz, rock, blues, and traditional Mexican folk and mariachi. No Passengers reunited for the Stage Pass concert. They've been on a bit of a hiatus following a debut album in 2013. Let's have a listen. No Passengers might be on pause. Edna Vasquez is anything but. A Mexican immigrant who made her name in the male world of mariachi music, Vasquez now has her strumming fingers in a number of bands and genres. There's a solo project, a quintet, No Passengers, frequent indie crossover collaborations with former E La Bamba frontwoman Luz Elena Mendoza, and more. But Vasquez got her start as a girl playing for her grandmother in Mexico.
The first time that I sang with my guitar, me learning this song for my grandma, I felt something inside, and I didn't know what it was. All I knew, it was very powerful, and I felt it in my skin. It was so overwhelming in a good way that I just closed my eyes, and all of a sudden I was in some other place, and I was just driven by the sound. Yo te encontré porque tenía que ser.
Yo te encontré porque me iba a perder. But she couldn't stay in Mexico.
It happened that it was so hard for me to go to school. One, because I was a woman, and the other one, it's because, you know, I came out to my mother, and she just saw that as, you know, that was gonna be a huge thing. There are some places where you cannot be different, like gay or, you know, because there's all this homophobia going on. So I came to the U.S. in 1989 for the first time.
She was 17. She moved to Hillsboro, where she joined the choir and learned a series of breathing techniques that came in handy when she was given a guitar and joined a mariachi band. It required learning dozens of songs and singing for up to 13 hours at a time. She calls it training herself to be a live jukebox, and she was the sole woman in a traditionally male world.
It was tough. Like, one of the comments that I had once was from one of the members. He played the guitarrón, which is the bass guitar, huge bass guitar, that only because I would wear skirts, I would attract the attention for being a woman, you know, and for being the only woman. That was the only reason I was in mariachi band, because nobody would appreciate my guitar playing. This is my case, you know. once they saw that I had the determination to be in a mariachi band, you know, it's almost like strong, that strong. They respected that, and they treat that as like a queen.
After No Passengers set, Vasquez sang two of her solo songs.
I sang Liberal, which it talks about being free of being a victim of myself, so I can move on through life.
Llegó la hora de zarpar. Decidido que hoy se marche el barco, que no tendrás ocasiones. La miseria y el dolor fue parte. Llegó la hora de volar y abrir las manos y soñar hacia un nuevo episodio. Solo basta imaginarlo y vendrá.
I get motivated to create a song, and then I create it, and then I see that expands, that meaning expands and expands and expands into a deeper, you know, thing that correlates all these subjects. It's amazing.
And this resembles the wings of a dove, just trying to be free.
After 12 years of trying to get legal residency, Vasquez is now in the final steps of the process. Soon she'll be able to travel back to Mexico to tour and play for her family for the first time.
I haven't been at home in 13 years, so I haven't seen my siblings or my parents, and that's been hard.
Which isn't to say she'll be going back forever.
It seems like in this 19 years that I have in Oregon, this is home. I found myself like for half of my life in Oregon, and it feels like this is home.
That was Edna Vasquez on OPB Music's Stage Pass, along with State of Wonder producer Aaron Scott. Vasquez is playing with Luz Elena Mendoza at the She Shreds magazine release show March 7th at S1 Performance Space. You can find some information for that, plus a link to the OPB Music No Passenger video at our site. It's opb.org/stateofwonder. Geronimo Johnson's new novel, Welcome to Braggsville, is a satirical but serious-minded story about a guy from a small town in Georgia, Deron Davenport, who goes off to college at Berkeley and gets cracked open by his collision with the wider world. A New York Times reviewer called Welcome to Braggsville the funniest send-up of identity politics, the academy, and white racial anxiety to hit the scene in years. While he's at college, Deron makes friends, four of them. In the conscientious confines of Cal, they hatch a plan that they think will open the minds of others. But their trip back to Deron's rural hometown goes irrevocably wrong. They arrive at a Civil War reenactment to stage a mock lynching. By the time everything's over, one of the four friends is dead. Geronimo Johnson has taught at Berkeley. You can also find him in Central Oregon once or twice a year, teaching at the low-residency MFA program at OSU Cascades. This is his second novel.
This book started on a cell phone. The voice that I wrote first was his Nana's voice.
His grandmother's.
Yes, his grandmother's voice, starting with the holler. And so that was written on my little cell phone, my mobile phone. And at first, Deron was African-American. That lasted for about a week, because I couldn't quite get the story to work around that idea. And also, it was going to become another tale of racial becoming that I felt would be too close to my first novel. And when I decided that it would make more sense for him to be white, then the story opened up. So that was probably one of the most critical points in the process.
So Daron gets himself a few weeks into the school year at Cal and starts going by Darren, makes friends, and the book is the story of this trip that the four friends make back to Braggsville. Darren and his friends feel really strongly about social action and about race, and they come up with this idea to do something to shock people out of complacency, a performative intervention. What got you thinking about street theater and the idea of something that a bunch of kids from Berkeley would cook up that would just go so horribly wrong when it was transplanted into a small town environment?
Well, first of all, I was thinking a good bit about one new media artist in particular, Mark Tribe, up at Brown, who had tried to recreate some civil rights era speeches. And he recorded them and then projected these images inside art galleries. A visitor could stand in the middle of the room and get a bit of the experience of being in a crowd. One day, while we were in a new media class, this project came up. And while it was being discussed, the class broke into two camps. One group thought that he was being ironic, that he was in no way, you know, being serious. The other half thought that he was sincere. And what I found very interesting was this split, and it got me thinking more so about how we make sense of what's sincere and what's not, and what's real and what's not, and how we handle irony. And then for quite some time, I'd also had in mind this question of, you know, what would happen if you expanded the diversity of the cast of characters at a Civil War reenactment.
The conversations people have in Braggsville are just dazzling. At one point, a character refers to one of the sheriff's deputies, I think, as a big slice of cop.
Yes. You know, I definitely wanted it to sound like its own world so that you felt like you were in a real place. Also, it needed to sound so different from Berkeley as well. You know, in Berkeley, most of the activity takes place on the campus, so the academic dictionary basically is sort of the farm for that language. In Braggsville, the demands are a little bit different. Things actually had to be, you know, like, created.
Geronimo Johnson. His new novel is Welcome to Braggsville. He'll be back in Bend in June to teach at OSU Cascade's Low Residency MFA program. Markeisha Babers is a working poet based out of Los Angeles. These days, she's using her writing to help other teens find their own voices. This weekend, she is also in Bend for the Muse Women's Conference. We caught up with her before the conference kicked off. Markeisha Babers, welcome to State of Wonder.
Hi, thank you.
Will you tell us a little bit about where you grew up in Watts?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a really bad part of Watts. I've actually moved around so much during my childhood, like I was never stable. But everywhere I went, it seemed to always be the worst part of the neighborhood, you know.
How old were you when you started writing your own poems?
I was 9 years old when I started writing my own poems. I had went through something, and I had really nobody to talk to at the time. It was a really hard situation for me, and I didn't know what else to do, so I started just writing about it. I just continued to write about it and write about it and write about it.
You know, it's obvious that you were going through difficult times with, you know, having to take care of your brothers and your mom's working and moving around a lot, sometimes being in between places. I'm not trying to crack you open like a can opener, but can you tell us anything about what was going on that needed to work its way to the surface?
We were homeless. We had been homeless for about 7 years. And I had a bad experience with a guy. And I couldn't tell my mom about it because they were close. So I was afraid to tell my mom, and I couldn't talk to my brothers because I didn't think they would understand that what had happened. So I was just, I had it just bottled up inside of me, and I didn't know who to turn to, who to talk to, or, you know, I didn't have, you know, a friend that could keep a secret, you know. And so that's what was really my main focus at that time, was like I needed to tell somebody, and the paper was the only person I could talk to.
Right. Well, will you share with us a little bit about how did you start reading your poems to other people?
The first time I read a poem out loud to an audience was at church. My mom, she had found one of my books that I write in, and she read the poem herself, and she decided that she thought it would be, I guess, good therapy for me to perform it for the church and get, you know, get some help with what I was going through. So she made me get up in front of the church, so I did, and that was the first time that I shared the poem.
How has your poetry changed as you've started to read it to people?
It went from during that very sad time in my life, from being of like very sad-oriented poetry, to more uplifting, like I've been there and I'm here to help you type poetry.
Will you read for us?
Sure. This poem is called Girl, and it's one of my newest poems. People only see me as that girl. That fat girl, just a little too black girl, always sitting in the back girl, that girl. People tell me, you're weak girl. No one wants to hear you speak, girl. Look at me, I'm not at your feet, girl. Stop crying, girl. It's not like you're dying, girl. No one will like you for who you are, and your career definitely won't go far. Not with that hair, those clothes, those shoes. You really need to change all of you, girl. Sometimes I tell myself, you know, depression ain't cute, girl, and you should stop waiting and do what you have to do, girl. I mean, if you're gonna end it, then do it already, girl. Just make sure you keep your hand steady, girl. You wanna get it right, girl. Just wait till night, girl, then get the knife, girl. It only takes one slice, girl. Look at you, too weak to take your own life, girl, but God told me, aren't you tired of waiting to die, girl? All you have to do is try, girl. I gave you your life to live, girl. I gave you your gift to give, girl. I am always here, girl. It's okay to shed a tear, girl. Just don't fear, girl, because you are that girl, made strong enough to carry the world on your back, girl. So stand up straight, girl. You will be great, girl. It is your fate, girl. Don't worry about the past, girl. Remember, who is first shall be last. So you've endured the worst, girl. Now it's your time to be first, girl. Then God held out his hands. He said, take this, girl. Don't waste it, girl. You'll know when to use it, girl. It's a miracle, girl. Like you, you are a miracle, girl.
Thank you. Would you tell me about the pivot in that poem, the point at which it turns from the voices, the negative voices in one's head, to messages of support and voices saying, yes, you can do this?
I didn't want it to just be a negative poem, just to end on a negative note. I wanted to show that there is a possibility to overcome. You are worthy of that. You are special. You are beautiful. No matter what anyone says, like, God created you and only God can judge you. Not even you can judge you like God can judge you. And that was the point of the poem that I wanted to present.
Markeisha Bavers, I want to thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us. And we're looking forward to seeing you and Ben this weekend.
No problem. And thank you so much.
Markeisha Bavers gave a speech at the Muse Women's Conference in Bend just this morning. You can catch her tomorrow at 1 p.m. at the conference for a workshop. Huge black and white photographs line the walls of Up 4 Gallery in Portland this month. The images look pretty abstract at first. Black backgrounds with irregular white shapes clustered across them. Step a little closer, and you see these are little tableaus made by the visual artist Rodrigo Valenzuela, and they've got quite a bit of detail. They capture structures he made for a show on view right now at Seattle's Fry Museum, Hedonic Reversals. The white shapes definitely suggest buildings, but the forms are so rough-edged. Are they under construction or in a state of decay? We asked Rodrigo Valenzuela.
They're like in this in-between point, and they are open for interpretation for what the viewer wants it to be. Some people look at them as a demolition, some other people view them like unfinished buildings.
Are these all images of works you developed for Hedonic Reversal?
Yeah, Hedonic Reversal is a large installation I built at the Fry Art Museum, aimed to figure out the way that we look at ruins or the aesthetic of ruins without taking advantage of the pain that ruins have implicit in them. I didn't want to go and document ruins in Detroit, for example, because I don't think it's fair for people that live in Detroit having this guy out of town over-aestheticizing their pain. It is a social issue.
I don't want to read too much into the places you've been living and working, but you have been in Seattle and Houston, two cities that have experienced explosive growth over the past two decades. Was looking around at those places very informative for what you've been working on?
Yeah, definitely both have, mostly Seattle, a big impact on this idea of the ruin, mostly in places that have a very recent history or not a very large past. You know, traveling around South America to Peru, and I travel around Mexico, Costa Rica, Guatemala. I have gone through most of Central America by bus or by ground, so I have seen how people understand their past. The ruins are there, and the ruins are present within a cosmopolitan city, or it's a source of knowledge of understanding themselves in the present. USA doesn't have too much of that, you know? The past or the ruins, they just mean in economic collapse.
Tell us a little bit about your process for the images that are on view here now.
I was thinking about the subject of the ruin. I've been making these plaster molds and little tiny figures, like very solid, simple plaster shapes that I paint white. So they're very, very monochromatic structures that they aim to resemble a structure or like a miniature. I photographed that. I go to the dark room, develop the film, I scan the film, I print it very large to like human size, like 8x8 feet. So this solid is a structure with all the details and all the problems that they have in this miniature, slowly they become the focal point. All the difference of texture, all the difference of quality, and all the difference in scale, they become very present when you have them in 8x8 feet. And then I paint 2x4s and I make these big plaster shapes that I place against the wall. And then I re-photograph that. The images echo in themselves and they generate the time. You can see the past and you can see that they will have a future if I keep playing this game of just re-photographing and re-photographing.
As cities build on themselves,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, you never know where they're going to go, but like you know that there's something present that can show you the past, even if it's not completely present there.
Among the many little jokes that Valenzuela builds into his tableaus are price tags left on some of the pieces of wood that make up his towers, pieces of blackboard chalk with just the right force perspective to make you think they're spare marble columns. On some, his own ghostly footprint is left in powdery white dust.
It's impossible to tell looking at these whether, as ruins, they were something wonderful and graceful or something functional.
But we have that relationship with all the ruins, you know, when you may go to Rome and be very amazed for this room and the beauty of the room or like the feelings that you get in the room. And if you do a little research, maybe the public bathroom from the Roman, you think that these places have like they're a bigger signifier than what they are. We are surrounded by like banalities and like things that make our life and make our culture. They're very simple. Like foam core and like plastic will remain longer than any of these things. That is what other generations will know us for.
Rodrigo Valenzuela. His exhibition, Hedonistic Reversal, is on view at the Fry Museum in Seattle and at Up4 Gallery in Portland. What, are we at the end of the show already? Jeez, how'd that happen? The executive producer of State of Wonder is Sarah Rothenfletch. Our technical producer is Stephen Cray. Aaron Scott produces the show with help from Phoebe Flanagan and Juan Ramirez. All of the music you heard on the show today was provided very kindly by the Lonesome Billies. They sent us tracks from their new album, It's Good to Be Lonesome, that's due out this summer. You'll be able to hear some of the songs when they play at Mississippi Studios coming up Thursday night, March 12th. Next week, we're going to dive into a collection of stories a little on the freaky side. It's called The Uncanny Reader. Get your flat circles all ready to roll. I'm April Baer. I'll see you next week.